shade. And I ain't got no money, but I damn sure got it made. Cause I ain't asking nobody for nothing if I can't get it on my own. If you don't like the way I'm living, you just leave this long-haired country boy alone.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Meat Trapper Radio. This is the, I guess you could say, late Thanksgiving, late Black Friday, what do they call it now? Cyber Monday edition of Meat Trapper Radio. I tell you, it's just insane what we've come to. I traveled to northern Tennessee to spend Thanksgiving with family, and on the way back, when I got close to home, I decided to pull into the local Target store that evening on the way home to pick up a few groceries, some milk and stuff like that. And the thought never crossed my mind that, you know, it was Black Friday. Well, actually, it wasn't Black Friday. It was late Thanksgiving night, I guess about 10 o'clock or so. And I foolishly thought I was just going to go to the grocery store and get some things. And I pulled into the parking lot, and I was absolutely flabbergasted at what I had gotten myself into. It took me about 30 minutes to get out of that parking lot. It was just insane. But, you know, the thing is there are some outstanding deals out there, but I am not going to wade into a crowd of crazed housewives to save a little bit of money. But what you can do is you can save money from your computer. Now, SouthernSnares.com has some outstanding Black Friday deals on their website. These are good through the end of the month. Brian's done a good job of putting these together, because let's be honest, people, there is not a lot of profit margin in trap supplies. You've heard Clint talk about this time and time again, but Brian has done a great job of putting together some good deals. The survival snaring kits are on sale. He's got some good deals on lures, to where if you buy one product, you get a discount on another product. So he's done a really good job of putting together some stuff. And if you need any type of lure, traps, supplies, and especially any type of snares or snaring supplies, check them out, SouthernSnares.com. Now, there's one other Black Friday deal that I'd like to mention to you, and that is the Meat Trapper Skinner. Most of you are familiar with it. Had a lot of people come by and look at them at the Southern NTA. I received the last five knives from Mark Hatchett. He's the master knife maker that makes the knives. I got the last five for the year. So what is on my website now? MeatTrapper.com. Click on Available Knives. What's there is there, and I am not going to get any more through the end of the year, and it'll probably be springtime before I get any more. Now, I have got one knife on there that is an absolute masterpiece. The handle is a Lignum Vitae handle. If you're not familiar with Lignum Vitae, it's an extremely dense hardwood. They used to make bearings, like machine bearings, out of it. That's how hard this wood is. But the amazing thing about this wood is that it has a tacky type of sticky feel to it. Very grippy, and it's really, really unique. I've got some very nice Brazilian cherry and a couple of desert ironwoods left. I've got one elk antler and model left, and one armadillo model left, and that's it. But check them out, and also check out the Meat Trapper on Facebook, my Facebook page. Chip, y'all all know Chip from Expandapan. He did a review of the Meat Trapper Skinner that he purchased for his son at the Southern NTA. And he does a real good job on that review. He shows that thing just cutting through ribs like butter. So anyway, enough of that. let's talk some trapping, because, you know, we've been off talking about history and politics and things like that, and I want to sort of veer back around what our core function is here, and that's trapping. Now, for those of you that are familiar with my YouTube channel, you've seen me trap out of a kayak a lot. And I get a lot of questions on trapping out of a kayak, because it's not easy and it's not simple. And I had a great question from Barry. So let me share what Barry had to say.
A podcast. It brought up a question for me that I'd love to ask you and love to get your opinion on. And that is, as you said, doing everything out of a canoe and a kayak. That way you're not paying to register it. You're not paying for the privilege of using what you already own to make the state kind of irrelevant in your hunting and your fishing and your trapping. I made that commitment for the exact same reason a couple years ago. I just did not want to register anything else with the state. I shouldn't have to do that. So for the last few years, I've been doing everything out of a canoe or a kayak, and I have found some challenges with it. I've had to modify a lot of my equipment so I can actually not waste my time out there, especially when it comes to trot lining. I had to start making my own shorter trot lines with like only 10 hooks on them. Had to start making lighter trot line weights so I could actually pull them up and not tip over. Started doing that with Wolffang Earth Anchors, those with 18 inches of cable on them. I just run that through two regular bricks and use a quick clip and clip it to the end of my rope. It actually makes a pretty good light little trot line weight that still sets the hooks and fish. But that's just an example, really, of having to modify stuff of what I'd normally do out of a motorboat. But I wanted to ask you about the difference between trapping out of a canoe and trapping out of a kayak, because I've been following you on Facebook and I've been seeing a lot of your pictures. You're trapping out of a kayak, and I tried trapping out of a kayak twice, and I really didn't like it because I couldn't carry a lot of weight. I couldn't organize things how I wanted to. The only day that I did halfway well with is whenever I was snaring, and I could carry a lot of snares on my person, and I could carry my spool of wire with me and my tie-outs with me. It wasn't taking up a lot of space. It wasn't too bad when I was snaring, but man, when I tried to run footholds and bring animals out, it was tough. It was tough, and it turned me back toward the canoe. Which, being primarily a foothold guy, I can carry a lot more equipment in a canoe than I can a kayak, but it has its drawbacks as well. It's not as nimble to steer. I've almost gotten into some trouble sometimes with log jams. When the wind's real high, it can blow you around a lot worse than out of a kayak. And I was just kind of wondering if you could maybe share your experiences, if you have some tips that would make, I guess, trapping out of a kayak a little easier. It looks like you have quite a bit of experience doing it. But anyhow, mainly just want your thoughts on the contrast between the two, because it's pretty cool. I like how it lets me get into water that most people don't fool with. So anyhow, if you choose to answer this, I appreciate it. Have a good one.
Well, Barry, that is a great, great question. And you're exactly right on all of your assumptions there. The one thing it did almost make me chuckle is that you said you had tried it twice, because most of the time I get emails from people and they say they tried it once, you know, and once was enough for them. But you're absolutely right as far as the lack of capacity. That's the big killer. That's the big drawback to a kayak, because a kayak has a lot of pluses. Number one, it's a lot lighter than a big canoe. You can throw it in the back of your truck. It's made out of plastic. You can drag it around, slide it around. It doesn't pick up weight wind like a sail. A canoe with its big high sides and everything, when you get out there and it gets windy, and that wind starts blowing and the water starts white capping, and you've got a heavy canoe and you're by yourself, man, it's scary. I mean, it really is. And so there's a couple of things that you have to do when you're trapping out of a kayak. First of all, if if you need some information on how to choose a kayak, go to my YouTube channel. I've got a video up there on, I think it's called How to Choose a Kayak or How to Choose a Trapping Kayak, something like that. And I go through all of the factors between the sit inside kayak, the sit on top kayak, the differences between a cheap kayak and expensive kayak, and what to look for, and the difference between a clamshell design and a roto-molded design, and the whole nine yards. I go through everything. So that's a must-see video. That explains a lot. But let's fast forward over that, and let's just assume that we've selected and purchased a good quality sit-on-top kayak, which is what you need for trapping, okay? You do not need a sit-inside kayak for trapping, and there's a lot of reasons for that. You can go to the video and see it. But the number one thing is, like you said, snares. If you try and carry a dozen 330s or a dozen TS-85s and then try and carry four or five beavers back out, it ain't going to work, okay? It ain't going to work. The capacity is just not there. So, in addition to using snares, you have to lay your line out properly. You have to think about where you're going and how you're going to lay the line out. Now, what I'm going to describe is the single most critical aspect to successfully trapping out of a kayak. And I have done this for years and years and years. But you're going to have to use your imagination, because this is radio. I can't show you a picture or draw you a picture. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to talk about how not to lay out a line in a kayak, okay? What I want you to do is I want you to hold your arm straight out in front of you, palm up, okay? Now, let's say the put-in, where you're putting your kayak in, is your elbow, okay? You're putting in at the elbow. You're going to run that line straight down your arm to your fingertips. And every 2 or 3 inches, you're going to stop and put in sets. That is the wrong way to do it, because you have a one-way highway and it is straight out and straight back, and you've got sets all the way down your arm, all the way to your fingertips. And by the time you get to your fingertips, you're going to be tired, sweaty, wet, freezing. You're going to have traps that you've pulled, maybe beavers that you've caught, and you're at the very farthest point away from the put-in that you can be, and you've got to paddle all the way back. Now, once you reach the fingertips, you've passed every set that you made. So you're paddling all the way from your fingertips back to your elbow, fully loaded, which is the hardest possible paddling that you can do. That whole trip back from your fingertips back to your elbow is non-productive and is simply hard. Now, you do have the option to paddle from your elbow straight to your fingertips and check those traps and sets, and then as you paddle back to your elbow, check the traps that you bypassed on the way up. The problem is, I have actually lost beavers doing that. I've had beavers break a cable and do things like that, to where I said, oh, I'll get him on the way back. And on the way back, guess what? He wasn't there. So don't lay out a line that is linear from point A to point B, and then from turn around at point B and come back to point A. Do not do that. Now, this is where you have to do a little bit of thinking, and this is easy for me where I'm at, because I live in an area where there's swamps and sloughs and bayous and all these kind of things. So what I'm doing on my trap line, let's withdraw our arm, okay? Let's start over. And all we're going to do is hold our palm up, okay? hold your hand palm up and spread your fingers out wide, okay? The put in is going to be at the heel of our palm. And what we've now got is from the put in, which is at the base of our palm, we've got five little finger creaks extended. We've got a thumb creak, forefinger creak, middle finger creak, ring finger creak, and we've got a little finger creak or slough or bayou. None of those creaks or fingers, we're going up very far. We're only going up a little bit of ways. So from our heel, the heel of our palm, what we're going to do is we're going to paddle a little bit up the thumb creek, and we're going to make a set or two. And we're going to come back, we're going to paddle up the middle finger creek, or the forefinger creek, and put in a set or two. And we're going to go up each finger and make a set or two and come back. Now what this does for us is this means we're never more than a short distance from the put in. So when we come back to check our traps and we put in at the base of our palm, the first thing we do is we paddle up the thumb creek and we check a set or two or three. And if we make some catches, we pull everything, get our beavers, and we paddle back to the put in and stack them up, put them in the base of the truck, in the back of the truck. Maybe we have an intermediate rendezvous point where we dump our beaver on the bank. Then we go up the next slough or bayou, the forefinger. Well, there's nothing there. We didn't make any catches there, so we pull our snares. No big deal. We go, come back down. We go back up the middle finger creek. And we continue up and down each creek, and when we make catches, we come back to our rally point. For those of you who have a military background, you understand the rally point, and that's our intermediate drop point. That can be the put in, that can be a halfway point where we're stacking beavers up. And so what we're doing is we're just paddling a short distance up one creek, coming back a short distance this way, a short distance that way, a short distance that way, and we're never very far from the put in or the truck. And we're never carrying more than a couple of beavers at a time. And then we dump them, stack them up. And then when we're done checking all of our sets, we're going to ferry them from our objective rally point back to the put-in. And this way, even if you're using heavy footholds like a TS-85, even if you're using 330s, it's much more manageable because what you've done, let's say your trap line consists of 12 traps. If you lay it out along a single line, you've got to carry a dozen 330s or a dozen TS-85s, and let's say you catch four beavers. You've got all of that. I mean, that's a humongous amount of weight, and that's very hard to get in a kayak and do, and it's very difficult. But if you break that 12-trap trap line into three fingers or four fingers, all of a sudden, that's manageable because you've only got two traps and maybe one beaver per load. Now, you're still going to paddle the same distance with as you would with a long linear trap line, but what you've done is you've broken it up into, instead of one long line, three or four very short lines. And it's much, much more manageable. And so to me, that is the critical thing. I always have a dump point, a rendezvous point, whatever you want to call it. And I have never had anybody bother dead beavers on a bank. You can pull weeds over them. I mean, they're virtually invisible. And so try that, Barry. And if anybody is interested in kayak trapping, please check out my YouTube video on my channel because I go into great detail about the different types of kayaks, the different constructions of kayaks, how they handle, the difference between wide kayaks and narrow kayaks, and what you need for trapping, and how it affects speed and ease of handling and tracking. And I get all geeked out on the kayaks that way. So the funny thing is, it's, you know, and that's a funny thing about YouTube. Some of the videos that I've put out that have gotten the most views, I consider to be the least helpful as far as instructing people. And the videos that I consider to be the most useful and the most helpful when it comes to instructing people and passing on knowledge are some of the worst viewed videos out there. It's like the average person really doesn't want the nitty-gritty, down and dirty, critical information because it's rarely what they want to hear. It's like the average person just wants feel-good, pablum puking sitcom type videos, and I don't know, it's kind of sad really, but that is true, and that's definitely something that I've noticed. Now, one topic I get asked about a lot is how do I conceal my traps, or how do I check them without being obvious? Do I have any tips or tricks in that regard? Because a lot of people, you know, you've seen things with people that have tried to rig up conibears that are down underwater, and they have a little electrical switch so that if the trap fires, a light comes on or something like that. Everybody's trying to do the same thing with these setups. They're trying to remotely check their trap. If you can check it from inside your truck, or if you can check your set while you're still on your four-wheeler or still in your boat or your canoe or kayak, you're not only saving money, you're not only saving time, but if somebody's watching you, like if somebody is fishing and I'm floating down the river, if I've got flagging tape hanging next to a trap and I go over and check it and there's nothing there and then I go on, those people in the boat that are watching me, they know something's there. They know something is flagged and marked. And guess what they're going to do as soon as I'm out of sight? They're going to go fool with it. You know, whether they steal it or just vandalize it or just finger poke it and screw it all up, you know, it doesn't matter. And the set is mine. It's my business. And nobody else really needs to fool with it or know about it or even know it's there. Another situation that's very similar in nature is when I'm doing ADC work. Basically, I charge for coming out and doing a check. And if I have a landowner who wants to do the check for me, that can save him money. It saves me time and wear and tear, and everybody wins. And so I've developed some systems where the landowner can do checks in some regards. And it's all a variation of the same system. And that's one thing I'd like to share with you. Now, I'm specifically talking about beaver sets, okay? I'm primarily a water trapper, a beaver trapper, and I'm going to either be having a snare that's set or a foothold or a 330. If I'm doing ADC work, I'm usually using some sort of a drowning setup. I don't use a lot of 330s, especially up near dry ground, you know, up on the banks or anything like that. It's just too dangerous. And so I'm usually doing footholds with drowners. And so let's say I've got a landowner who's, you know, having some rose bushes and some trees and shrubs cut down, and I've gone out and I've made some sets. And he wants to get up and check them every morning before he goes to work, and if there's anything, then he can give me a call. Well, if I've got footholds down in the water, that's really difficult for a non-trapper to determine if I've made a catch or not, especially if I've got two footholds set at one set. He has to be able to look exactly where the footholds are, determine that there's no trap left in the trap bed, and then call me. And that's just asking a bit too much for a non-trapper to do. So what I have developed is I will take a piece of string or a piece of cord or something like that, and I will tie it to a nondescript object. It could be a stick. It could be an empty plastic water bottle, a piece of trash, a Coke can, an empty Coke can, anything like that that's normally found on the bank that wouldn't arouse any suspicion. And I'll put that right up on the bank somewhere, and I'll have a short piece of string, say 12 inches, 18 inches, whatever, depends on the situation in the bank, and I'll tie that to the trap chain. And the idea being, if the beaver comes along and he steps in the trap and then he slides down the slide wire or the rebar, he's going to drag that little piece of trash behind him. And that's why I use like an empty water bottle with no lid on it. You know, you don't want anything that floats or is buoyant, or a stick or an empty can or just whatever you've got. But when that landowner comes out, when he looks and that stick is gone or that water bottle is gone, he can see that from 20, 30 yards away. He can look out his window sometimes and see that the little piece of trash is gone. And, you know, I tell him, if that's gone, you call me. And that makes it real easy for the guy to walk his perimeter and see if anything's been disturbed. Because, you know, the beaver's not, you know, the beaver or a coon or whatever is not going to come and just grab an empty Coke can or a piece of trash or a stick and do anything with it. It's only going to be disturbed when they go down that slide wire. I will do a piece of flagging tape, orange flagging tape. If it's on private property and the guy wants to get out a pair of binoculars, say he's got to look across a pond, I have no problem putting a piece of flagging tape attached to the trap chain and have it up on the bank off at an angle or whatever. And then when that beaver is caught and he goes down the slide wire, that flagging tape is drugged down to the bottom of the slide wire. And that's something you can check 100 yards away with a pair of binoculars. So if I've got a guy looking out his window, I mean, he can literally scan all the way around his lake and tell me if anything has been tripped. And that's just a huge time saver for me, a huge money saver for him, and everybody's happy, you know. So I do very similar things when I'm out in the field on public land. The one caveat to this is when you have changing water levels, boat wakes or anything like that, you've really got to take that into account and into consideration, because you can have stuff that's disturbed. I mean, you know, let's be honest, everybody knows these days you're not cool unless you have a bass boat with a 300 horsepower outboard motor on it and you're doing 60 miles an hour down a 15 foot wide creek. You know, that's, you just got to do that. That's just, if you don't do that, you're just nobody. And you know, when I've got a beaver snare set in a slide, that just wreaks havoc on my sets. And so that's very difficult to deal with. And just on Corps of Engineer land, they're going to release water or drain water or whatever. So you can't predict when the water level is going to change. And that can float stuff off and have an adverse impact. But overall, it just depends on your situation. But that is an excellent way that I have found that saves me from having to visit every single set, get out, go up, look. A lot of times if the water's muddy, I'll have to actually put my hand down in there to feel and see if that trap is still in the trap bed or not. And that all takes time. And if I can just paddle by, casually glance over at the bank and tell if I've made a catch, if there's something on the bottom of that slide wire or not, that's a huge time saver. So just a quick tip and something to keep in mind. Now, one last thing I'd like to talk about tonight before closing the show up is many of you are familiar with a buddy of mine by the name of Barry Holland. And Barry has been a contributor to the show in the past. And he's got a YouTube channel. And he is starting a new series. And what he's doing is he's showing his methods for trapping beaver in the rocks. Now, the first episode that he put up, and I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes below. It's really, really good, and I would urge everyone to go subscribe and watch it. But it's about 30 minutes long, so set aside some time. But it's very, very instructive. And what is so interesting to me is how different trapping methods have to be depending upon where you're located. Now, traditionally, most people would think that trapping methods would vary widely if your geography varies widely. In other words, let's say we've got somebody up in the far north of Canada up there, you know, Quebec or Ontario or whatever, and we all know, you know, we have this idea in our head of them trapping through the ice and going out on a snowmobile and cutting a hole in the ice with an axe and putting stiff snares down there and wiring up bait and all of that. And that's just real alien to somebody from Alabama. And that's to be expected. But what I found interesting was Barry lives in Arkansas. I live in Alabama. We're not that far apart. I mean, just a few hours. But the methods that he has to use and the methods that I use are radically, radically different. And that was the one thing that struck me was how close you can be geographically, but how different your methods have to be based on the topography and the terrain that you're in. And the more I thought about it, the more interesting it was, because where I'm located, if I go 1 hour west, I'm in terrain that's almost identical to Barry's. And I've never trapped much over there because it's all rocky and the rivers are solid, the banks are solid rock, and you know, there's beaver there, and you'll see floating sticks and peeled sticks and all of that. But it was just too much of a pain in the butt when I could drive 15 minutes from my house and be in nice, soft mud where everything is real easy and I can use snares and all of that. And, you know, it's just interesting because you get on the internet and you see all of this stuff about how to do this and how to do that and the best way to do this. It all depends. And that's the one thing that I want to pass on to people is that it all depends. You can't look at one person and say, this is how they do it, therefore that's the best way. Because the methods that I use in soft mud are useless in rock. And some of the methods that Barry has to use in the rock would be overkill and sometimes counterproductive. Down here in the mud and the brush and all of that stuff. So I thought that was very interesting. And as he does future episodes of that, I'm really looking forward to it. And it's funny because even though I'm not in the same type of terrain that he's in, I've already picked up a couple of tips, and I'm not going to give them away. You got to watch the video that I can use on my line and in my terrain. And so even though the methods are different, there's always these little things that you see somebody else doing, you go, why didn't I think of that? Yeah, that's a really good idea. And that's the beauty of it, is sharing ideas, sharing information, and everybody becomes more efficient and more productive in their trapping. And so I hope everybody is out there hitting it nice and hard. I know I am. And it's interesting because as knife sales pick up, because just in the day since I started recording this episode, I've sold two. And so they're going fast, fellas. If you want them, get on there, meattrapper.com, go to available knives, check them out. What's there is there, and there aren't going to be any more this year. And if you're looking for a nice Christmas present for a customer or a client, or if you want to send a link to your wife and give her a sort of a wink and a nod. And if you have any questions, email me, meattrapper@gmail.com. But now's the time to be burning it up and stacking the fur and stacking the meat. And I hope everyone had a wonderful Thanksgiving. And we've got Christmas around the corner, and that's the best time of the year. So anyway, thanks for listening. I hope this was useful, and we'll see you next time.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a going dry. The interest is up, and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. A woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive. And a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those wooden moon boys raised on shotguns. We say grace, we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. We came from the west line. Your coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade blade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.